Welcome to the 63rd lesson in our study of Revelation, John's Revelation. I've entitled it Transition, the Gentiles to Jews. And we will be looking at Revelation chapter 10, verses 1 through 7. Let's glance at those now. I will read them. Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head. And his face was like the sun, and his legs like pillars of fire. He had a scroll open in his hand, and he set his right foot on the sea, and his left foot on the land, and called out with a loud voice like a lion roaring. When he called out, the seven thunders sounded, and when the seven thunders had sounded, I was about to write, but I heard a voice from heaven saying, "Seal up what the seven thunders have said, and do not write it down." And the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, that there would be no more delay, but that in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the seventh angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. So here we are, trying to make sense of this. And we're trying to make sense of this primarily from a Gentile perspective, because that's what most of us are in the church. Gentiles, non-Jews. And thus far, Revelation has been primarily directed to non-Jews. We had the intro, where Christ was revealed as high priest. You had the letters to the churches. You had the prologue of describing heaven's throne, which is the center of focus for all who are saved. And everything proceeds from this throne, by the edict of the one who sits on this throne. Then we had the seals of what I've come to call the indictment scroll. And we had the trumpets. And throughout this, the emphasis, like I said, has been toward Gentiles. There has been points of focus on the Jews. I would be remiss if I did not address 144,000 of the 12 tribes. But primarily, the focus has been on Gentiles. And God has been working with mankind corporately. This is the overview. But here we are at the pause between the sixth and seventh trumpets, and it signals a transition. The angel who comes down and stands on the sea and on the land simultaneously. And he swears or announces that everything that needs to be revealed is now revealed. And so Christ's patience with all sinners has ended. Once this angel comes and stands on the earth, and he makes this declaration to all on the earth, and we'll cover this in toward the end of the lesson, because if you're living during this period, you won't hear anything, and you won't see anything. But it doesn't make it any less real, because this declaration is not given directly to sinners. It involves them, but they've had their opportunities through the seals and the trumpets. And so the second age is now drawing to a close. Christ begins the separation or the winnowing of true Jews from false Jews. The fulfillment of Jewish promises that he made to them. And he did so in Deuteronomy 32. Now, for Deuteronomy to make sense to us, and it really doesn't to most Gentiles, because we don't understand the format. We don't understand what's actually occurring in Deuteronomy. Actually, the name means the second giving of the law. They are about to enter the promised land. And so Moses is reaffirming the covenant made at Mount Horeb. Not just the 10 words, but the entire covenant that makes the Hebrews a theocracy, that makes the Hebrews his chosen people. Remember, they had a covenant meal with Christ, the pre-theophany Christ. And they agreed to do all this. And now it's being restated to the next generation. And they accept it. And it ends with six of the tribes being on Mount Ebal and six of the tribes being on Mount Gerizim, and the blessings are pronounced by one group and the cursings by the other group. And God, through Moses, details what will happen when they fail the covenant. And it has happened. But now, God is going to pick them back up. Now, if you're a replacement theologian, believer, then this makes no sense to you. And Revelation, as it was given to John, will make no sense to you. So you must allegorize it. You must assign meanings that are meaningful to you, not so much to God, not so much to John. And this has been the problem throughout the dispensation of first fruits, or the church age, if you will. They make it up as they go along, because just as the Jews, as a body, rejected the covenant and rejected the Messiah, the church, as a group, corporately, has done exactly the same thing. Now, we covered this in the church letters. Shouldn't be a shock here to anyone who's been following the lessons. The church has succumbed to the Hegelian dialectic Gnostic philosophy and has wandered off into the world, after the world. There's still the church here, but there's not Christ Church here. I want to be clear about that. When he descended in the air, not to the earth, and sounded with the voice of a trumpet, "Come." The church, the true church, the true believers heard that voice and were caught up to meet him in the air. The true Jews, and they don't know who they are, they're not hiding around in the enclaves saying, "We the true Jews, we hide now till God calls us. We got everything ready. We got the garments. We have the plans. We have all this. We're just waiting for the call." No. That's a fantasy that certain fundamental Christian groups put forth. That's not true. That's not what's happening. They don't know whom they are. But they will know who they are because they will be the ones to hear the call. Once again, this should not be a shock to anyone who's followed along. And I'm actually doing this a brief synopsis here because this sets the stage and opens up the great tribulation. This is where God, or Christ actually, specifically works with the earth and the peoples, nature and peoples, though they're not specifically, I would say, aware of it, because certainly some are. When they, in Revelation chapter 6, when they say the rocks hide us, fall on us from the face of the wrathful God who's causing all of this. There is this certain knowledge that is in the earth, on the earth. And thus the seals, and then the six trumpets, is Christ focusing their attention on their sin, on their separation from him. And not in vengeance, not just to be mean, but if they were gods, they would be able to control nature. It is to show them they are not gods. It is to show them that they have no power. They live in a world of delusions. And this is true even today. The whole concept of worldview is just a delusion that one has built to justify one's sin. And the maturation process, the hagiazo process as I've come to call it, that Christ puts Christians through is to peel away that worldview, your personal worldview, to peel it back layer by layer so that you begin to see yourself as Christ sees you. And you cling to him ever more tightly, which is as it should be. But the world does not. The world doubles down on their sin. Henceforth, throughout the rest of this book, until Christ comes, Jews are the primary focus, followed by saved and lost Gentiles. I'm going to make that differentiation because this is the separation of the wheat from the tares during of the second age. Now we're going to have it again in the third age, the millennial kingdom age, which would be the last dispensation. And by the way, if these terms are not familiar to you, first age, second age, third age, you need to go back to the beginning. If the Hegelian dialectic is not familiar to you, you need to go back to the beginning and work through the lessons. You can't just jump in the middle of this book and expect to comprehend it. We all do it. You get saved, you get excited, you read John. It's so easy to read. It's so easy to get caught up. He's such a humble Jesus, and he you know, come follow me. I am the way, and we all jump on that bandwagon, and then we run to Revelation so that we can see how it ends. Because John, and it reads easy, and it flows smoothly. And neither book are easy to understand. John has a wonderful writing style, even in the Greek. But it doesn't mean that it's simple. The concepts are simple. I mean, the overall writing flows and appears simple, and easily explains these deep concepts that God wants to get across to us. Now, who is this mighty angel? It's there in the Greek. He's mighty, all right. He's an angel. And he's not named. But I believe the name is inferred. I remember when we started the study in Revelation, we said you had to have a good knowledge of, first of all, the entire Old Testament, but especially Daniel, Ezekiel wouldn't hurt, and Deuteronomy. Or more, you know, to be specific, but more generally, the Pentateuch. You had to know these. Revelation is the final exam of the Bible. And it's not based upon your learning, though learning is certainly invaluable to understanding it. But you can have all the pedigrees and degrees in the world. You can be fluent in these languages and not have a clue because you're not saved. Because you must be taught via the Spirit of God. 1 Corinthians 2:14. So I believe that this mighty angel has a name. Well, they all have names. But I believe we know his name. Now, only three angels are named in the Bible. Gabriel, Michael, and of course, Satan, who really doesn't have a name, he has a title. And it's probably true of the other ones as well. Titles. In the Old Testament, almost everything that we call a name is actually a title. It's not reflective of their actual names. And in some cases, historically, we may have access to their actual names and not be that aware of it. Gabriel means of God, or God is strong. And he's seen three times in the Old Testament. So it behooves us to go there and look at him. So let's turn to Daniel 8, 16. The clicking here in the background is me clicking on the computer, because That's where my Bible's at. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So his name is given here. It means warrior of God or man of God or God is strong, depending on which source you look at. But certainly, warrior of God, it would be a mighty angel. So let's go to Daniel 9:20. Just flip over a few pages. And while I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my plea before the Lord my God for the holy hill of my God, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, and we had just read that, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. He made me to understand, speaking with me, and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. This is Gabriel. He is to give insight. He is to give understanding. He comes from God to God's people so that they may understand the message that Christ wants them to have. Let's go to Luke chapter 1, verse 13. And many people are probably familiar with this little ditty here where Zechariah is a priest. His lot comes up. He's called to Jerusalem, and he's to minister to in the temple for that month, or at least that week. And he's in doing his duties with the altar of incense, the golden altar. Now, we've spoken about this golden altar several times. It is the most prominent altar mentioned in Revelation. Not the sacrificial altar. That's outside the tent. That's outside the tabernacle. And it has no meaning and has no place in Revelation because Christ has already been sacrificed. He's already ascended. There's no more sacrifice. There's no going back to animal sacrifices. So those people who are waiting for Israel to build the temple and to do the sacrifices, that would be an abomination to God. You cannot sacrifice Christ anew, afresh, continually. There's only one sacrifice. It was done, and it will not be repeated. And the animal sacrifices were looking forward to that one sacrifice where Christ was the Pishash, the Paschal Lamb, the Passover Lamb. But the angel said to him, do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. Of course, that's John Baptist. And of course, Zechariah, being a good Israelite, a good priest, said, now, I heard everything you told me, but how do I know? How do I know this? How can I trust you? I'm an old man. My wife is advanced in years. We're going to forget that thing about Abraham and Sarai, from which begun the Jewish people. And the angel answered him and said, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to you to bring you this good news. And you want to sign? Okay. You're going to be quiet for a while. And you're going to be quiet till he's born. In fact, he's going to be quiet. You are going to be quiet until you agree to call his name John. They didn't actually say all that here, but the way the events played out, that's exactly what happened. So Gabriel stands in the presence of God. Gabriel comes to the Jews. Gabriel comes to be the hermeneutic messenger of God. He is to bring meaning to what God is saying. And that is exactly what is happening here. This mighty angel, warrior of God, blazing out spiritually, with one foot on the land and one foot on the sea and right hand raised to the heaven, announcing Christ's message to the world. More specifically, to the saved. So that's why I believe this is Gabriel. Later on in Revelation, we're going to see the other named angel, and that's Michael. And of course, Satan runs throughout this. So beyond the spiritual and earthly distinctions, some already elucidated in our studies, Revelation now reveals the subtle and not so subtle interplay between the three major forces at work in man's history. Government, work religions, and economies. They began under Cain and were resumed at Babel. And I want us to understand this. Cain was the first one to bring these forces together. He built the first city. Genesis 4:17. To have sinners live in such a compact area. Now, we think of cities as sprawling and spread out, but that's a relatively new phenomenon because we have cars. We have modes of transportation for most people. But throughout most of history, travel was limited, and people were packed in on top of each other. Rich and poor alike. You know that when you have a bunch of sinners packed in together, you got to have rules. If you don't have rules, you just got a lot of dead people because there can be only one. And to make your rules stick, they must have a foundation to legitimize them, and that is your religion. It's hermetic. Hermetic is the one actual false religion that stands in opposition to Christ's revelation. It has always been so. The Hegelian hermetical dialectic It flows outward around the world being works-based. And we're going to see all three of these forces at work. One of them is very subtle. Even in history, it's very subtle. It's present, but it's always in the background. And thus, we're going to see it in Revelation once. And it stands out in stark contrast because it takes such a prominent place all of a sudden. And I've always asked myself, even as a teenager when I was reading Revelation, and I was lost. I'd sit down and discuss with my mom from time to time. And I was wondering, why are they here? Why are they being mentioned? Because they're not mentioned elsewhere in the book. Here I am, basically an old guy, and now I come to understand why. Because they've always been there. So Gabriel descends from heaven, not from outer space. We're not having aliens landing. There weren't aliens in the past. There's not aliens anywhere. There's no life anywhere else in the universe. Because God made life here. The hermetic evolution, spontaneous generation philosophy that morphed into evolution and eugenics and all of that, postulates that if life is here, then it must necessarily have come into being elsewhere through natural processes. Except we have not defined clearly those processes or how they even can do this or begin. In fact, even the very definition is fraught with contradictions. If the very definition violates the law of non-contradiction. Because at its core, evolution says life comes about and man came into being through random processes. Random is random. But evolution says, well, we say random, but we really mean always upward. A couple steps back, three steps forward, it's random. That's not random. Random is entropy. So the very foundational definition is incoherent, does not follow, is non sequitur. This angel has, in the English they call it a rainbow. In the Greek it's an iris around his head. It is indicative of the angel before the throne in Revelation chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Let's go there a moment. And I saw the right hand of him who was seated on the throne, a scroll written within and on the back sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals. Here's that mighty angel. Is it the same one? Probably. Because where is Gabriel? In the presence of God. Out of his own mouth he said that. And here we see the mighty angel in the presence of Christ, sitting on the throne. And who is worthy to open that? Jesus. So you have the Son of God, Christ, sitting on the throne. And you have Jesus, the Son of Man, who took on the form of man to pay the price for our sin. And what is the color of this iris? It is green. It is green because that is the color of mercy. In the Old Testament, when they viewed the throne room, it was wreathed in flame and fire, and a river of fire flowed from it because the Father's holiness had not been satisfied. It had to be satisfied. And Christ sat on the throne because no one has seen the Father at any time. John 1:1-18. But the Son of Man has seen the Father and he has paid the price. And when he presented himself before the seraphim, before the throne, he was found approved. And instantly, the throne and the motif of heaven changed from the fire of holiness to the rivers of life, rivers of peace, greenery of peace, with the trees of life lining it. Of course, we'll get to most of that toward the end of Revelation. We're kind of jumping the path there a little bit. So he has this iris, once again showing that he is from the throne room. He has stood before the throne. He got his message directly. Now, Satan, before he was Satan, the accuser, which is what the name means, was over the throne of Christ, clothed in multicolored hues. We get this in Isaiah 14:12-15, Ezekiel 28:12-15. But when he fell, he lost that position. He no longer reflected the brilliance of the Father that flowed through Christ. Thus, he lost. He was cast down from that position. And Gabriel was cast in his position, not being over the throne of God, but being before the throne of God. In other words, there was only one who was over the throne. Now Gabriel stands before the throne. See, being over the throne made him higher in position, not in the chain of command, but in position, and it kind of got to Satan. It kind of fooled him. He said, hey, I'm over Christ. I'm great. I'm wonderful. And I want to do it my way now. He forgot he was a created being. Christ is not a created being. He came out from the Father, but he was not created by the Father. He was always with the Father, John 17. See why you have to know all of Scripture? Otherwise, you just put cobble things together and they don't make sense. So when he fell, that multicolored iris, boom, it's gone. It was put in the sky and is our rainbow. And it's not a full iris, it's just a rainbow. It's a partial iris. And is the promise of redemption to us. And also the promise that he would not use water to wash the earth clean again. Which is why in the Great Tribulation, we're not seeing floods. We're seeing somewhat of the same phenomenon as occurred during Noah's cataclysm, with the breakup of the fountains of the deep, the moving of the tectonic plates, the earthquakes and volcanoes and all this, but they're subdued, relatively speaking. So rather than all this occurring in 1 year, wiping everyone out, it's occurring over a 7-year period. So that the tsunamis do not wash mankind off the face of the earth. And you can make book on this because the rainbow is there to tell you this. Everybody can see it. Now, when I say everybody can see it, I mean everybody. Satan can see it, only it's not a promise to him. Well, it's a promise of his judgment. Every time that rainbow shows, him and the demons are reminded their judgment is coming. It will come in its appointed time. And the reason that Gabriel has a face like sun and legs like bronze is because he's taking on the appearance of Christ. He's standing before Christ, and the glory that is washing off of Christ is so powerful that he has taken on some of that, those signs of glory himself. Now, it's not gone to his head and he's saying, I'm God, like Satan did. But this is why he has this appearance. Is for our sake. Remember, he's a spirit. He has no form. He takes on whatever appearance he needs to take on for this particular mission he's on. And we had the vision of Christ on the throne, actually before John, in Revelation chapter 1. And this is why it's continued here. Revelation keeps referencing back to what is already spoken about earlier. It's a cycle pulling us back in layer by layer by layer, giving us the essence of the meaning. And of course, bronze means the penetrating justice. The face shown like the sun is the glory of the light of the Father through the Son and through unto all who believe. We are lights of the world, taking out the gospel. If indeed we are not trying to shudder it like Scrooge in the Christmas Carol story. Where do you think Dickens got that imagery from? He got it from Christ. He got it from Matthew, Sermon on the Mount. We are the light of the world if the gospel shines through us. We should be humble that God can work through us. It also means that the world hates you. And so many people would rather be friends with the world, like Saul, and dim that light, and God is not happy. And this is why we have the Hagiozo process, because we all do this. Saul was not an anomaly at all. He was just like us. Now, what's this little book he holds? And there have been speculations ad nauseum on and on and on. Well, it's given in what's known as diminutive form. That's why it's called small book. It's not the same book as was given to Jesus in Revelation chapter 5. I believe that what we're seeing here is the rest of John's revelation. It's being given to him. Now, is he actually being handed a book and said, here, you don't have to write it down. I done it for you. Like God did to Moses writing on the tablets of stone? No. Why do you write on tablets of stone? He really didn't have to. But he did it, and the reason is revealed in Ezekiel, because they had hearts of stone, and God is going to give them hearts of flesh. When? At the end of this whole process in Revelation. As a group. And when this book is revealed, when John writes it down, all that he's seen, all that he's hearing, that he's allowed to, the canon of Scripture is complete. Any mystery you had about the Father, about the Son, about the Spirit, about the gospel, about salvation, has been revealed with the completion of this book. If you have any doubt of that, we go to Revelation 22, 16 through 19. And he tells us that. And we'll cover this in more detail when we finally get to it. I, Jesus, well, it says outside, being outside Jerusalem, are the dogs and sorcerers and sexually immoral or the immoral people. And these are, of course, the sinners that are locked into the lake of fire. And adulterers and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. Outside are them. But I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you, to the saved, about these things for the churches. He's talking about everything now. That which occurred before the tribulation, because he's going back to addressing the same people he addressed in chapters 2 and 3. Because these things have not happened yet. They're going to happen, but they have not happened yet. So that's why I believe this is actually referring to John's revelation. That's why it's small book, because it's just a part of the entire canon of Scripture. They say, well, I have lots of questions about who God is and how God works and why. You do. I do. And it would be impossible for us to know what the Father and the Son and the Spirit knows. Why? They're infinite. We are finite. There is no way that we can possess the complete mind and knowledge of God because we are finite. That is why we rest in Him. We can know a lot, but at some point, we reach that area that we cannot get beyond. Even now, the whole idea of the empirical, resting upon the non-empirical, Hebrews 11:3, shows that there is a point that we can't get beyond in explaining how things work. Science is limited to the empirical. You can look at all the parts, but it's like you can take all the parts of a car engine. And you look at it and you go, wow, yeah, okay, that's a lot of parts. But when you put them together and turn the key, you're going, wow, how did all that work? And we can explain parts, but we reach that point where we can't get beyond. Energy. We look at energy by its effects, but we cannot define its essence. Same concept. This is why it's by faith. All life is by faith, even for the lost, because they have the same issues. Why do they define what is good? What is their base? Well, it's, I believe it. We believe it. We want to believe it. It's common to man. But why? They can't get beyond that point. They take it by faith. Thus, this brings to a close, or begins to bring to a close, this portion of Revelation, this portion of man's history, this portion of the second age. That's why I call it a transition. Because he stands over the land and the sea. Now, as Christ's herald, we also saw him as Daniel's messenger, who at that time swore with both hands, announcing the Jews' redemption. And he declares Christ is Lord over heaven. And here he declares Christ is Lord over heaven, reaching up and earth, represented by land and sea. And this signals the change in focus to the Jews. Let's go to Daniel 12:5. Chapter 12, verse 5. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others stood, one on this bank of the stream and one on that bank of the stream. And someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. And he raised his right and his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and half a time. And that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things would be finished. And I heard, but I didn't understand it. Then I said, oh, my Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the winds are shut up. The words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. Now, having a foot on the land and the foot on the sea shows Christ's dominion. Remember, Christ is the creator. As shown in Colossians 1:15 through 20. He is the creator. And so Gabriel is swearing by him, because God can swear by no other. There's no one greater than himself. Book of Hebrews. Gabriel, well, he's not the power. He has access to the power because he's faithful to Christ. He's a ministering spirit, Hebrews 1:14. Thus, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. What Christ tells him to do. And this shows that there is no battle over earth. Satan cannot overpower God. He cannot overpower Christ, who is God, who is given his mandate directly from the Father. And remember, the false prophet, as we're going to study in Revelation 13, arises out of the land. But the Antichrist arises out of the sea, the restless, raging sea, which is that part representing Satan who's constantly raging and restless and never quiet, but whose boundaries are set. But man comes out of the land. Man is made from the land, from the dust of the earth. And from men comes governments that are based on religion. And Gabriel speaks with a lion's voice, Christ. And we get this from Revelation 5:5. When the Son of Man, Jesus, takes the scroll, the indictment scroll, from the Son of God, Christ, sitting on the throne, he is identified as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Not Satan the lion, who's roaring and driving you to the kill, but is the lion who speaks with the voice from the Father. And he's answered by the seven thunders. And we hear or read of God, the Father, talking in Scripture, because you never see him. Christ through John tells us we have never, no one has ever, ever, ever seen the Father. Ever. Because he's spirit. You never seen the Father. That's a flat statement. Excludes nothing, includes everyone. No one has ever seen the Father but the Son. Well, the Son who came out from the Father, obviously. In several points in the Bible, the Father speaks, and it sounds like thunders. He did so in Exodus 19:19-20. And there's passages in Amos and Joel, and even in John, where his voice is the sound of thunder. And John was told to seal the message of the seven thunders, because the message only for John. Just like Paul had a message that was only for him. He could tell us about his vision, but he couldn't tell us the essence of his vision because it was only for him. And from that, his writings, we gain an understanding of the essence of what he was told. Same way with John. John is being strengthened and prepared for his mission. Now Daniel, remember when we read in chapter 12? He was told to seal up his message. In other words, the meaning of his message. I would say he wrote the words down, but the meaning of the message was not given to Daniel. And Daniel said this. He said, I don't understand. It's okay, Daniel. Just write it down. No one's going to understand it until the end. And what was Daniel to understand? What John is writing down. What's in that diminutive book? What is in our book, Revelation? That is what he is not explained to Daniel. Daniel was comforted. You don't have to understand, you just have to write it. But we are comforted with the knowledge. But with that comforting of the knowledge should come a great concern over those who reject that knowledge, who reject that message. And that we'll cover in our next lesson. But that message for Daniel was to be for the latter days, and now it's revealed to John. Now Gabriel raises only his right hand here. Before he raised both hands, now he's raising only one hand. Why? Well, the other hand, figuratively, is holding the book. Holding the book out to John. Once again, that's be for the next lesson. Gabriel's the bridge to us, based on the authority of the messengers originator, which is Christ, the one true creator. And like I said, that is in Colossians 1:15 through 20. And what's the message? Well, essentially, it's done. No more delay. When the seventh trumpet sounds, remember the trumpets is announcements. All mysteries of God revealed and authenticated by the subsequent events. Mankind has had his warning. Mankind has had the opportunity since Christ ascended for 2,000 plus years and however much longer it takes. And even during the first part of the tribulation, it's warning man, warning man, warning man. But now it's done. At some point, there is accountability. At some point, the plan must progress. And this pivotal moment is entirely non-empirical. No one's going to see this. If you lived during this time period, you're not going to see anything. You're not going to hear anything. But events on earth will become more intense. Gabriel's presence signals the transition from man generally to Jews specifically. Jews were in the background, but now Gentiles will be in the background. There will be a general summation of history from a Jewish perspective as Christ grafts true Jews back into the branch. Of course, Paul talked about this in Romans 11, 21 through 24. Henceforth, there will be accountability, judgments, which grow in severity, sinners being held accountable. All sinners. Earth and his people are being prepared for the king's coming to establish his kingdom, i.e. the third age, the millennial kingdom. This is not a war between good and evil, light and darkness, or Christ and Satan. That is a fallacy. That is the hermetic lie. You have an opportunity. The darkness is just as essential to good order as light is. That's like saying randomness is essential to order. Well, no. It's absolutely contradictory to good order. Events are the natural result of Christ allowing sinners to build a world without him. Remember, Romans 1, 18 through 28. God let them go. He gave them up to do what they wanted to do, to build a world without him. We've seen this in history. History is a detail of man's failure to build a world peacefully. Building a world, all right, but it's not peaceful. It's violent. It's degrading. And it relies on force underneath. Natural cataclysms result when Christ allows men to pretend they're God, to discover they can't control nature. Man wants to be as God. That was the original promise in Genesis 3. But all they've achieved is violence with degradation and rampant death via disease and famine and wars, the result from ungodly or acerbated governments, religions, and economies. Man's attempt to control spiritual imbalances, he calls them mental illnesses, by force, by drugs, by transhumanism, increases sin's disastrous influences. Acerbated or ungodly man doubles down, even while knowing truth, as in the days of Noah. Noah was a witness of God's message of coming judgment through building the ark. That was his preaching. But their lives appeared normal, so they ignored him. Then God sealed the ark. Noah didn't close the door and seal the ark. It was fashioned and constructed in such a manner that when the waters came, those doors pushed against the ark and were sealed. And Noah could not open those doors for nothing until the waters abated and fell away from the door and it could open. Everyone became accountable for their choice at that moment. That's why Noah is such a powerful figure and is mentioned in 2 Peter and in 1 Peter and in Hebrews 11:7. And Gabriel declares the coming judgment. And it preaches to the lost. But your living message preaches to the lost also, like Noah. But what are you preaching? Are you preaching light? Or are you preaching darkness because you just want to get along? You want to have those relationships. Now, I'm not saying we need to go out and beat people over the head with the truth and get in their face and be obnoxious about it. But you need to live in the power of the Spirit via the new nature. That's all you have to do. You don't have to go out and plant a flag and saying, rally to the flag of Christ, and everyone who doesn't is filthy, lost sinners and deserves whatever they get. That's not what Christ does. That's not what Christ did. He just came and taught the Father. And they hated him. Then they killed him. And that's why we don't do it. We want the world to love us. Because we still have the body of flesh. We still struggle. Paul struggled. Peter struggled. We all struggle. But if we knowingly dim the light, what does that say? Are we actually saved? I said the prayer, so God will save me. It's not fire insurance. That's not how it works. Salvation is a change of nature. 2 Corinthians 5:17. Old things have passed away. Behold, everything is new. You are a new creation in Christ. And a new creation will live differently. Just like an infant. They're people. They don't act like people much. But as they grow, they're being trained and they act more and more like people, hopefully, especially at salvation. What do people see in you? Are they seeing the darkness with which they are comfortable so they can call it light and enlightenment? Or are they seeing the true light, which they find very uncomfortable? We are not to be the ones to attack them, but they will be the ones to attack us. If you're confused about that, go back and read the Sermon on the Mount, especially the Beatitudes. They end with, you will be attacked. But when they attack you, they're not attacking you. They're attacking the Christ in you. And that is what the rest of the book of Revelation is going to deal with. Their attacking of Christ. And Christ coming to establish his kingdom. Thank you.